This is a Glassbox Media Podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Blank Podcast, the podcast where we talk to well-known guests about their lives, their careers, and negotiating those difficult moments along the way. I'm Giles Perry Phillips, and with me, pre or post fringe, or in between, during even.
It's during, it's Jim actually,
Daly.
Yeah.
It's Jim Daly.
Hello,
it's
hello, during. Hello. Yes, it's during. This comes up on the episode with our guest, Ollie Phillips. I've got the guest in so early this week,
yeah.
Who is absolutely fantastic.
Eager Beaver.
But we talk about being on the fringe, but I say during the recording, I think this will come out after the fringe. It's actually going to be mid-run, I think. So yeah. By now, I'm going to be about 2 weeks in, I think.
So it'll be really good. This is the perfect time to come and see you then.
And see me, yeah. I've literally just checked my Twitter and someone's just messaged me saying, I've put some tickets for the 8th, so they'll have come and gone. So a few sales are going up, which is lovely. So, but yeah, I can't wait to be at this point. That's weird me saying it now, but like, I'm looking forward to what the show is going to be like at this point. But if you are someone that is at the fringe or is coming up for the next couple of weeks, please do come and see my show. Jim Daly, Football and Fatherhood, 4:30 p.m. at the Grass Market Centre every day. Tickets from edfringe.com. It would be lovely to see you there. Wow, that's the earliest I've done the promo for that.
Yeah, nice.
I'm proud of myself.
I've teed it up. You knocked it away. Yeah, like you say, we've got a brilliant guest today. It's Ollie Phillips, who is a rugby player who played sevens and 15 aside for England and obviously Newcastle as one of his big teams. Played alongside Johnny Wilkinson.
Yeah.
Who everybody obviously knows as being a phenomenal player. And it's some really interesting insights into Johnny. And in the dressing room and stuff, isn't there? And his practicing and lot of self-doubt and stuff that he sort of had about his abilities. And that's really interesting. That obviously got us talking about all sorts of different things with regards to Ollie's career as well.
Yeah, fascinating guy. I mean, incredibly successful rugby career. But also now, off the back of that, and he retired quite young for 29 for a sportsman, for a rugby player, talks about that being quite a low moment in his life and the difficulties of that came along, but then also fueling that to go on and do some of the stuff he does now with Optimist Performance and talking about positivity in coaching and helping people sort of reshape their mindset as well to get the best out of themselves as well. So much that you and I resonate with in terms of the positivity angle and getting people to focus on the goods and the wins, and you know, a lot of stuff we talk about on the podcast. He's an absolutely ideal guest for us, but also a fascinating sports career. Chance for you and I to obviously ask our nerdy sports questions that we love doing when we're sportsmen. Come on. And and the stuff about Johnny Wilkinson, which was very early on in the episode, very fascinating as well. But Ollie is also just a really good communicator, you know, and again, that's what he works on now, as well, helping people improve their communication. But he's just a good talker, good at stories, and just so it's fascinating talking to him, and just an absolute top bloke, even if he, you know, is a Brighton fan. It's fine.
I know, but it can't be perfect. and you can see why he was a captain for his various teams that he played with, because he's got all those leadership qualities. And I know he was, you know, again, that was something he was self-deprecating about. He sort of talked about his positive and negatives that with regards to his captaincy and some things he learned post-career about how better to work leadership and stuff. So yeah, really, really good. I was gonna say it was a really fascinating conversation overall. You were saying that there was a lot of stuff that we could come alongside, not so much the elite sportsman bit though.
No, that's a really nice bit at the end where he was like, you know, imagine we all play for Palace in the Premier League, and I like, honestly, I can't even imagine it.
Well, you've played at Selhurst Park. I haven't.
Mate, I've scored at Selhurst Park.
I've been in the goal at Selhurst Park.
Okay, so there you go. We've both been involved in a goal.
I was in the goal at an open day. They let people on the pitch, basically.
It still counts.
Yeah, I do a presentation when I go do school events and stuff, and I do talking about becoming an author that is one of my prime pictures of me standing in
the goal.
Yeah, that's where the abuse starts to start. Like, it's where I lose. It's where I lose the audience mainly.
Oh man, but no, Ollie is just, this is a fascinating episode,
yeah.
And he's a really inspirational guy as well. And again, especially someone that's played right at the very top, talking about the difficult moments as well in that career as well. This is where this pod excels, really, when our guests are happy to come on and talk like that. So, absolute legend. And we're going to get into that episode very quickly. Before we do that, I believe you've got a...
Well, I've got some
Facebook review.
I've got some messages on Facebook.
Here we go.
Do you remember Facebook? It's that old social media.
I do thing. Because my Facebook profile, Jim Daly Comedy, has started to get a little boost recently since I started doing some more videos. So suddenly I'm like, oh, I will use Facebook.
So social media, retro social media people.
Yeah. We love anyone on Facebook. We love anyone on
Do you think
platform.
Like there'd be so many like, do you think like people that are really into TikTok will start to retro actively go on to things like Facebook because it's
well, at some point,
let's see what the olds are doing.
No, but do you not think at some point, because like social media moves so quickly, that TikTok will be the Facebook for the next generation? So probably, it'll be old again soon. There'll be a new one people are moving on to. But you're on TikTok, are you? Oh, all right.
I wonder granddad. What the next one's going to be then.
It'll be some like hologram in your head or something. It'll be, you know. I'm going a bit too far ahead there.
I think whatever it'll be video content because that seems to be the only thing that people like.
For everyone,
which is great for people like you, Jim. Not so good for people like me.
It's very easily done, Giles. I'll help. We'll make it happen. It's very easy.
Thank you. Anyway, I've got two lovely messages. One here's from Rosa Lynn Horton. She says, "Wonderful podcast, enjoying it immensely." And I've also got another one here from Claire Paley. Maybe part of the family, like
maybe.
Yeah, this is this is an endorsement from a distant relative. She says, "Great people, and it's a must listen." So there's two nice messages there. About Frank.
Well, that is. Thank you so much for that message. It's lovely to hear that, and lovely to hear that people are enjoying the pod and getting things out of it. Hopefully, they're going to get loads out of this episode, Giles, aren't they?
They really are.
This is, that's kind of seamless. It wasn't too bad. This is the one and only Ollie Phillips on the Blank Podcast.
Fantastic to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Perfect. Yeah, no, great to be here. Thanks very much, fellas. Love it.
No, thank you. Well, I think we just sort of mentioned off air where we all are in the world. And I know your place of birth is Brighton, which is very, very near me. Did you grow up there as well?
Yeah, I did, mate. Seaside boy, mate. Cut me open, bleed seagulls. That's what it's all about.
Well, you're with two Palace fans today.
Well,
so
that's a disaster.
You might be regretting saying yes to this.
We might have to cancel this interview straight away. I was born and bred in Hove, actually. And then I went to school down that way, so St Christopher's School, and then Brighton College, but. Not when it was like the best co-ed school in the country, I think. It was when it was a pretty ordinary school and they just let ordinary lads in at that point, of which I was definitely one. Whereas now you have to sort of be basically Barack Obama in the making.
It's bizarre so, how that's changed, isn't it? And I know people who've got, because obviously branched out of Brighton as well. Like I've got some friends who live in Dubai and their kids go there. So there's branches everywhere.
Yeah, everywhere, mate. The tentacles just reach far afield, yeah. The Middle East now.
So was that where you found your love of rugby?
I was useless at football. So two left feet. And so I think, I was quite a fat kid. So I was fairly boisterous as a, like 3-4 year old, and I think my mum and my old man were fed up of me sort of clubbing my brother over the head or clubbing the kids in my nursery over the head, so they threw me into rugby fairly early down at Hove Mini Rugby Club. And because I was sort of big lad and I could run around, I was okay at that, and I just sort of took to it like a duck to water, really. I love the environment, and I mean I never I'll be honest like I never thought I'd go on and you know, played professionally and whatever. I did the classic of, you know, when you're 9, 10 year old, you imagine you're playing for England and saying all that sort of stuff. But I didn't ever really think it would materialise into anything, and until I hit my sort of, I don't know, mid to late teens or something like that, really, where it's all started to start to become a bit of a reality.
Was there a moment where you suddenly thought, oh, I'm going to actually, I am good at this, I'm actually going to go pro? Or you're talking to two guys here who have never been professional sports people. Is it a slower process than that?
Well, as a schoolboy or whatever, you start off, you play counties, you play for Sussex, and as a 13, 14-year-old lad, and then when you get to 16, that's when you get 15, 16, you get under-16s England and all this sort of stuff. So you start to get a sniff and a flavour of playing for your country. But no real sort of mentioning of professional contracts at that point. And when I was playing, the clubs hadn't really got themselves organised. Now they're sort of snapping kids up at 12, 13. Yeah. But that wasn't the case for me. And it was only really at 17, 18 where Harlequins came knocking, and I played in the Middlesex Sevens with them, alongside Hugo Monnier and Nick Duncan. We were the sort of three lads that came through at that point in time. And we won Middlesex Sevens, and it became this sort of like, oh, wow. You know, before, all it was good for was me sort of getting street cred, because when you've got a face, only your mother can love. I was dependent on rugby as sort of for me to sort of pull the odd chick and whatever else. So, whereas, you know, then it starts to become a reality of like, oh, wow, somebody might, you know, it starts off initiative, they give you expenses. I'm like, wow, I'd have done this for free. I'd have paid to do this, and you're actually going to give me some cash. And then I'm in my first contract ever. Was at Newcastle Falcons, and it was £600 a month, all in. And I thought it was, wow. I thought it was the greatest thing I'd ever had in my life.
Yeah,
honestly, I thought it was absolutely sensational. I couldn't afford any food or anything like that, but I just couldn't believe it. I was still living off like Tesco Value beans and whatever else, but it was just amazing that you get. As I said, I would have played for free, so it was. That's sort of when it materialised of like, oh, this could be a job and a profession, and for me. It accelerated pretty quick. So from me signing that contract in the June, I was picked to play for England in the December.
And also, how were you like, because obviously being in Newcastle, that's a long way from home.
Yeah, southerners don't go well up north.
No.
Though,
so, well, see, my family originally from Durham, so we're kind of used to that area, but...
That's where I went to university.
Yeah, so yeah, great. So, yeah, so they're from Crook. So funny enough, my grandmother was from there, my dad was brought up there, but they moved down here. But so we always had kind of, you know, summers, we always went there for summer holidays and stuff.
I'll be honest, I absolutely love it. It's a beautiful part of the world. Yeah. Amazing fun. And you know, truth be told, I went to Durham because I ballsed up my A-levels. I got too interested in rugby and women rather than in grades, which was an error. I was predicted AAB, and I came away with BBD. So that was a results day was interesting dynamic with the family in that one. And I was meant to go to London School of Economics to study economic history with economics. So I would have had no crack whatsoever. thankfully, they turned me down because I was meant to get AAB to get in there. And Durham's entry requirements were ABB, but they rugby saved me a little bit. They said, look, you know, because your rugby pedigree and how you interviewed will accept you. And so I was like, oh, bloody hell, I better go get a proper degree here and do something. So I went up north, and it was, if I'm honest, it was the best decision I ever made in my life. As you said, beautiful part of the world, awesome university, and... I'd had to sort of make a choice between Harlequins and my degree, or education, if you like, at that point, because it had gone Pete Tong. And I chose to get my degree, and luckily within 6 months a year, Newcastle would sort of come knocking and I joined them. So it all worked out right.
But that's really interesting, because obviously in other sports like football, the players aren't making... university decisions at I guess in sort of 17, 18, it's all in. I know academies now have changed and they offer more educational stuff alongside it. But so is rugby different in that sense? Is that more of a thing, or is it just because of your A-levels?
No, there's definitely, I think, yeah, because the world of football, you know, if you make it properly in the Premiership, you never have to work a day in again, really. I mean, if you sign a contract to whatever, 50, 100 grand a week, I mean, that's more than people making in 3-4 years sometimes, right? So, so I think because of that dynamic, every sort of minutiae detail is put under the microscope. And so, you know, at the early ages of even like 9, 10, these kids are in their academies and they live and breathe it and they stay overnight and everything. You know, rugby's not there, but it's certainly moving in that direction. Mm. But, you know, the money's nowhere near the same. So as a result, you know, when you finish playing rugby, you can have earned a tidy salary, but you still got to go out and find a job and another profession. And so education's, I mean, I'm not saying that it's right that it's not part of, you know, footballing curriculum or whatever, but the need in rugby for you to have something to sort of fall back on and some form of educational structure is still there. So I think that's a positive as well. I think for me, it was definitely a positive anyway.
Yeah, because I've been, it's not that long ago. I mean, you know, when I grew up watching the likes of Brian Moore and Will Kine and stuff, they all had, you know, they all had jobs. They were, you know, they were doing rugby was a kind of
thing they did the weekends. Doing the day and go playing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. In the good old days, in the sort of amateur semi-pro days. I mean, I missed that. I wasn't a part of that. Rugby went professional in, I think, 97, 98, and then I sort of became professional in 2003, 2004. So just as England won the World Cup, actually, is when I sort of signed my contract. At that time Johnny Wilkinson was at Newcastle, so it was a you know, good place to be, hanging on his coattails and pretending like you're his best friend, so that, you know, people will talk to you.
I remember he did that advert, didn't he? It was with Adidas, where he was. I think that's
Beckham.
And Beckham. Yeah, that's right. And they were both taking free kicks for the other ball and stuff. So
yeah, he was an absolute wizard with any kind of ball. He was a genius. I mean, it just made me incredibly jealous that his mate was David Beckham. He texted him. I was sitting there, come on, like, sort me out. Let me meet Beck.
Exactly. Yeah. Get me Beck's number. Yeah.
But it must be really inspiring to have someone like that around, though, to lift you. I can imagine that lifts everybody's games a little bit if you're somewhat, you know, there's someone so naturally gifted.
Yeah, you know what? I mean, Wilco was obviously very talented, but naturally gifted, he definitely wasn't the most naturally gifted of blokes. He was just, honestly, a total freak in terms of how he could apply himself. I've just never seen anyone that could be so focused and determined, and he was obsessive, properly obsessive. I mean, he talks about it now, but, I mean, the things he would do in order to become the player that he was were just, it was endless. Like, he would do anything. I remember, you know, after sessions, you do a few extras, you know, you go and do a bit of kicking or whatever else. You do whatever, half an hour, and then that would be a good session. Wilco would go, and he'd create rules. So it'd be like, I don't know, I remember one used to go to the corner flag, put the ball on the corner flag where it was. So you're looking sort of perpendicular to the post, so you're only seeing like the very thin post. He'd put it on the corner flag, and he'd kick, place kick, and he had to hit the post square on from that angle, side on.
Wow.
Had to hit it 20 times. And if you missed one, you'd start again.
Oh my God.
So, sometimes he'd be there 6-7 hours, just constantly going and going and going. And mentally, that's where he was just unbreakable. I mean, unbreakable.
I guess with that, like, top level sportsman, because you hear that a lot with in various disciplines, it's an obsession almost, isn't it? I think
I've never met a player the same as him. I mean, there's lots of players that were very professional, you know, verging on obsessive. He was at the unhealthy end of obsessive, right? But the result, the irony of it was he was so, he talks about it all now, right? But he was so obsessive that he could never actually be like content or happy with his performance because there would always be something wrong. There was, it was always striving for this perfect game, which is never possible. But, you know, so you play a game and score 28 points, absolutely boss the whole thing, but he would have missed a kick to touch and therefore it would have been a failure. It's something like that, I don't know, right? It was that, it got too far for him, whereas probably the best professional was a guy called Matt Burke. He was fullback, won the World Cup with Australia, fullback, cool as a cucumber on the field, even cooler off it. You know, just a good bloke, but equally super talented and got the balance right. And he, luckily, when I was sort of 19, 20, he was on the field with me, screaming and shouting at me, and I was sort of learning from him. He was almost like clairvoyant. I'd be on the field, he'd be like, he'd scream like, "Oi! Oi!" I'm like, what, what's the matter? He's like, "Stand there." And I'm like, "Okay, I'll stand here." He's like, "This is what's going to happen. He's going to run here, they're going to come here, then he's going to kick down to you on third face." And I'd like play out in front of me. He'd run there, run down the side, kick to me. I'm like, "Oh, cheers, Bertie." He was just unbelievable. So I learned a lot from him, and that was sort of where I, you know, have, like, grew up or matured as a player with the likes of him and Wilco around me, which is a massive honour and privilege.
Definitely. I think it's really interesting talking about that, the idea of being satisfied, though, because I think that is something you can apply to any kind of career, really, no matter what you're doing, that you do obviously have to push yourself and try, but you do have to sort of give yourself the breaks now and then and be... You need to... Because careers are up and down. I imagine top-level sports very much so, and you'll have difficult moments and stuff, and obviously people learn from that, and you dig in and you try and get better, but, like, you need to give yourself the wins when you have a good day and be able to recognise that, because that's... Otherwise, what are you doing it for? You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I mean, you've got to celebrate the wins. I mean, as we're talking about him, Wilco talks about himself, but 2003, England never won a World Cup, ever. And still haven't. He kicked the winning drop goal to do it all. Hero of the moment, all the rest of it, everything he worked for, strived for. You'd think after that, I mean, you don't necessarily get drunk, but you think you'd have a celebration of some sort, probably for about a week. You know, and some people just won't remember anything because they got so drunk, and others just celebrate, right? Wilco went to his room, played guitar. didn't go out, didn't do anything, yet. And was actually critical of like what he'd done in the final. I remember him telling me, and I was like, "Mate, that's, you know, surely that's not where you. That's what this is. That isn't what this is all about. I mean,
yeah,
you've just won like the pinnacle of our sport, and you were actually the main man." That's done it. Okay, fine. I mean, I don't know, you might have scuffed the kick here or not missed a tackle there, but you've won it, you've done it. Like, as you said, Jim, like, you make mistakes as you go through, right? That's part of learning, and that's what experience is all about. But he couldn't celebrate. He'd done it, and it was like, oh, that box is ticked, but this wasn't right. I've got to get that right the next time. And, you know, it's a real shame. I mean, it's such a shame because he achieved some amazing things in his career. And if you don't, as you said, if you don't celebrate them, it's about sort of, everyone always says it, like, enjoying the journey and all that sort of stuff. But it's really true. Like, if you didn't celebrate the fact that, I mean, you started off not being able to do something and you finished off by being able to do something. Like, it's that process in the middle of, wow, like, this is what I did, and this is how I broke it down, and this is where I got it wrong, and, wow, like, that whole learning experience is what makes it special. The end product is like just vindication of the effort, if you like. But yeah, he just really struggled to celebrate that because he was so obsessive about the perfect game, I guess.
Yeah.
Which you say is... It's completely impossible. Elusive. You can't have the perfect game.
It will just never happen. It will never, because there'll always be something. You can always do something better, right?
Yeah.
You kick the ball 50 yards to win the game, or you could have kicked it 60.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you'll find something, won't you, if you're looking
There's
for it.
There's always something, right? Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah.
As you said, just being happy about the process, the outcome, celebrating that. Because I talk about this quite a lot, but the irony of all this stuff is, and this doesn't mean this is the case for everyone, but for me, all my greatest experiences ever in my life are shared experiences. I never go, oh, Giles, Jim, let me tell you about this story when I was on my own.
Yeah.
Right. No one ever starts that story. It's like, oh, do you remember when we won a World Cup together? Or do you remember when we went out and you got so drunk you fell over and da da da? Like, it's always shared experience because I think that's what makes it sort of special. And I think it's about like really enjoying those opportunities and those moments that you get to sort of look back on and go, wow, do you remember when we did that? I mean, can you believe that we did that? Or do you remember when we did a podcast and blah blah blah? Like, there's just that.
Yeah.
It's that shared moment, whatever it is, how big or small, doesn't really matter. But that's what makes it all sort of special.
And it's like telling yourself like it's okay to enjoy those moments. I don't know if it's a British thing, maybe, but like I know we get very awkward about sort of like, or I certainly do, that maybe someone might think I'm being arrogant or whatever about my success or something. And so you don't want to be seen to be throwing it in people's faces or any of that kind of stuff. So you just don't enjoy it or celebrate it to avoid that kind of thing. And same with compliments. Someone gives you a compliment, you're like, oh no, actually it wasn't that good kind of thing. But it's okay. Like, people want you to have a good time. People want you to enjoy what you do. People sometimes want to live vicariously through you and your successes, and that's okay. So it's like telling yourself, it's okay to enjoy this moment. It's okay to accept that compliment and be like, oh yeah, no, it was cool, thank you. But I don't know if
I mean, it's quite
if it was a British thing or a human thing.
I think, well, it's a bit of both. I think it's very British, right? But I think it's also, we've all probably done it too, where, you know, someone does celebrate it, like, look at that arrogant knob over there, like, you know, you know, like, oh, wind your neck in or something like very British thing to put somebody down to.
Mm.
Whereas, I don't know, in America, it's like, I don't know, they learn how to ride their bike and it's like they're, you know, they're going to be Carl, whatever his name is, Carl for the you know, I'm the world superbike champion or something like that, right?
Yeah,
like Frampton, yeah. Well, I didn't know if he was the boxer, but anyway.
Rossi,
there you go. Anyway, so I was just thinking, you know, whereas the Americans are really good at sort of shouting about how good they are, and they actually celebrate it, like, you know, the land of opportunity, the land where you could be anything you want to be. I think. But the irony of all this, it's only because it happened on Monday, but I was friends with the Caroline Flack, you know, the lady who was on Love Island, who unfortunately sort of took a life. And she, I remember she saying something in one of her tweets or whatever, and it always stayed with me. And she said, look, in a world where you can be anything you want, be nice.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it always just sticks to me of like, so now, because I used to be that bloke who'd be like, I don't know, jealous of somebody achieves something, but oh, not bad doing that, or you know, mind you, again, or you're just so arrogant, or you maybe delight a little bit in when somebody failed or whatever else. Whereas I'm like, okay, well now I just try and celebrate everything that people do, and it's, and I'm trying. I don't always live up to it, but you know, try and, you know, so in a world we could be anything, be nice, and it's sort of a bit of a philosophy now that I try and live by. So, anyway, that's a bit of off on a tangent.
No, not at all. No, no, and it's
ideal tangent for us.
Yeah, yeah. We like tangents. But yeah, no, it's so true. And I think when we encourage others and are nice and kind and compassionate to others, then we end up being nice and kind and compassionate to ourselves in those moments as well. You know, and actually, like we say, give ourselves those moments to enjoy. It's not just about, you know, giving it to other people, but actually allowing ourselves them.
I'm not sure if it stems from maybe a societal thing or maybe a British thing. I don't know, right? But there's always been this. There is a general impression of like, well, you can always do more, right? I mean, you can always make a tenner, but you could make 100. If you make 100, you could make 1,000. If you make 1,000, you could make 1,000,000, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's always like you could always do more. There's always more. There's always more. There's always more. And you know, as a result of that, we go through sort of our process with quite a critical lens on everything we do. So it's not like, oh, I did really well to make that 100 quid there because I did this, this, and this. It's like the approach, in fact, this is ironic. All the worst coaches I ever worked with playing wise would be, you'd win a game and all we would review on the Monday would be all the things we did badly.
Mm.
Even though we won the game. be like, this is what we did wrong, this is what we did wrong, this is what we did wrong. It's like, well, look, we won the game, so we must have done something right. So yeah. Why don't we talk about all the things we did right? So that then it's a mindset shift of, like, you're focusing on all the things that you do super well, reinforcing those so you keep reproducing positive outcomes. And I found that, you know, a lot of the worst coaches and the people were always the ones that were, don't get me wrong, you want to keep improving, of course, but the ones where you just focus on all the things that you did badly. And I found that was quite a big psychological shift in how I approach games, how I approach my teammates. I read a book, it was called Decide to Win, and it helped me really change my sort of outlook on, like, playing, being captain, you know, leading, all that sort of stuff. It was, and the philosophy of it was, there are loads of people that hate losing, and there are only a few people that love winning, and ultimately the outcome is the same, but the process and the, if you like, the enjoyment factor is very different. The philosophy of, like, I just love winning, so you'll try everything, you'll explore different avenues, you'll always be, if you like, be inquisitive and adventurous in how you explore different routes and avenues and opportunities of winning, in inverted commas, whatever that means for somebody. Whereas if you sort of hate losing or you just fear losing, your whole mindset is always focused around just doing better than whoever you're against, just being that, like, extra inch in front of them. And it means that you sort of never really fulfill your proper potential, because your actual benchmark is just against somebody else or another team, and that's all you're going against. And I found that quite an interesting philosophy, philosophical outlook on life, but on playing in particular. It's quite deep for a Friday, lads, so sorry.
We like that. Joe, as you're talking now, I was actually thinking about Crystal Palace, and sorry, Brian Panthers.
You often do.
Every episode.
What, you're thinking Brian love winning and Palace just
To be fair, last season, first season, they finished above us in the top flight, so you know we'll give them that one.
I remember a ridiculous story that is obviously horrendous, but, you know, all the Palace, Brighton, when they play against each other, and it was in the playoff. I'm sure it was in the playoff to come up to the Prem.
Here we go.
And didn't a fan, either a Bryant fan or a Palace fan, I don't know which way, break into the change room and have a
It wasn't
know,
a fan.
I love when stories do this, that they get the extra level on it and go,
it wasn't a fan. It was a player.
No, so it was actually, well, the rumour from the Palace side, and this came from Paddy McCarthy, who was captain at the time during a live evening, I think, was that it was the Palace coach driver who'd had a dodgy stomach problem, got the coach there before all the players, rushed in, used the toilet, had a very bad experience, and there wasn't able to clean it up properly or something, so it ended up not looking great. So then the players come in and they're like, oh, who's done this in the changing room? Well, it must be Brian. And weirdly, yeah, it must be a mind, you know.
There was a rumor it was Gus Poyet at one point.
Gus Poyet, who's the manager? Charlie Oatway. I heard it was Charlie Oatway.
Come on,
just
lads,
a manager.
Don't ruin these stories. I mean, it's much better that it was Gus Poyet going and having a turn on the Crystal Palace changing room floor than their bus driver just had a dodgy Ruby Murray. And that's
exactly.
But what's great is, like, obviously they didn't, that none of them, this came out like years later, so none of them knew. So they genuinely thought it was Poyet or Oatway. So Holloway, the Palace manager at the time, used it in his, like,
I don't need to do a team talk, lads.
He's like, yeah, look what they've done. And of course it worked. Palace won 2-0 on the night. So weirdly, they turned it into his team talk.
What was the bus driver doing? Just sitting in the corner going, they don't know.
Wasn't me, lads.
They don't know. I'm the key to your success, but they don't know.
Yeah, we got promoted to do it every game in the Premier League. They say 38 times next season.
Maybe Holloway just engineered it. He said, look, drives, go in ahead. Yeah, yeah. Have a crap on the floor. I need something bigger.
Eat this. Honestly, it's fine.
I'll make a big thing out of it.
Oh, God.
Oh, man. What was I going to say? I was going to say about
the shift that we've had that last season from Roy Hodgson, who was very much someone who probably had, and I say this with a lot of love for him, because I think he's one of the best friends we had, but more of a negative mindset towards playing. And it was...
Not losing, like basically.
Had,
not losing.
Not losing, sorry. A bit like when we had Sam Allardyce, who used to talk about respecting the point. You know, so it was all about this. And now Patrick Vieira's come in, and it's the exact opposite. Palace are playing to win, and the whole mindset's changed, and the style's changed. And actually, it is working fantastically. And last season was probably the most enjoyable season as a Palace fan that I can ever remember watching. But I understand why some people maybe at high level sport might be wary about that kind of thing, because I guess a lot's at stake, so it might be safer to that other mindset.
The best in from a footballing perspective, and this is, I don't know these individuals very well, right, but just from looking at their outward approach, which for me is the transition from Mourinho to now Guardiola and Klopp. I would say Guardiola and Klopp are in that, let's go out and just express ourselves and really love winning, right? Just be adventurous and play the best football that we possibly can. We keep the ball. We just want the ball all the time, all the time. Yeah. Whereas Mourinho would be like, let's set up to just frustrate everybody here. Yeah. And then when the chance comes, boom. Right? And both really effective. And Mourinho won loads, right? I'm not saying you don't win with that sort of mindset. But I know what I would rather watch, right? And I know what I would rather play in. As an environment, and you know, I think as a legacy at the end of it all, cool, you've got all the trophies and whatever else, but can you honestly turn around and say, oh, that was the best version of me? There's loads of players that would be able to say that under Mourinho, and because that's probably what they're really skilled at, was just being frustrating and annoying and defensive mindset, because that was their capability. But you know, the best talent, I think, If you give them that license to be them, is pretty potent.
Yeah, and if you look at Jim, I was going to say you could argue that brings the best out in the players as well. You know, they play to their highest ability.
But everyone too, like not just them. I think the ripple effect across fans, you know, supporters, manage the whole club, right? It becomes more that mindset that everyone would have heard. You know, whatever it was in NASA when they went to that, you know, the janitor, and they said, "What are you doing?" And he's cleaning the toilets, and he said, "I'm putting a man on the moon."
Yeah,
you know, like that. Like you feel genuinely like you are contributing towards a bigger cause, and it's such a positive environment to be in. And I feel like, well, I don't know, I'm not in amongst it all, but I just think that approach to things is much more positive as a whole, right? Mm. As a general contributor to everything. So
I wonder if that mindset is changing in sport, because you look at someone like Mourinho in the last couple of years, struggled really to get a lot of success at his clubs with his technique, and as you say, Klopp and Guardiola are doing very well, and Vieira coming in at Palace, and I wonder if the mindset's changing. But I go back to when you were playing, and you were sort of saying, like, you know, that coaches would look at the negative, because remember when I was playing football, there was like two types of player. There was the player that like would react to being shouted at, react to being told you're doing badly. And then there was the arm round the shoulder kind of player.
Yeah.
And I was definitely an arm round the shoulder. I needed someone to say, look, mate, you've done so well today. Look at that passing. That was great. As soon as they said, like, what are you doing? You're rubbish today. I would just like shrink into my shell. Do you think that's changed?
No,
it's still the same.
No, I mean, that's human behaviour, right? There's different types. The key skill set as a coach or a manager is understanding those nuances of, like, I don't know, Giles needs to bang his head against a brick wall and me tell him he's crap because that's how he reacts. But Jim, I've got to give him love and lucky bum taps and whatever else. Like that.
You
know, that's
how this pod works, actually.
Yeah. So that's, if you like, individual human psychology, human behavior. Where I think the best and the worst coaches, like, if I were to sort of explain it, would be like, how do you focus on people's like super strengths rather than areas where they can go? So I don't know, we all get selected, let's just say, for I have a bizarre moment, I decide to play for Palace, right? So we all get picked to go to play for Palace. We've all got some X factor that's got us in to play for Palace at the beginning, right? So we start off like this, our super strength and like all these other bits that, I don't know, you might be brilliant at being a striker, scoring goals, but you're not so good at defending, right? So if I, as a coach, say to you all the time, awesome, Jim, thanks very much for coming in. Like, we know you're good at scoring goals, but like, you're not so good at defending. So like, over the next, you've only got 24 hours in your day. Of the 12 hours that we spend training, I want you to spend at least 9, 10 on defending.
Yeah.
So your super strength that got you in the first place starts to diminish because you don't spend any time on it. And the thing that you're pretty rubbish at and you don't really like, you start to improve a bit, but you end up in the middle, right? You end up somewhere here. And then you get fired. And they sack you in your contract and they're like, well, mate, why have you sacked me? Like,
I get transferred to Brighton.
You get transferred to Brighton, right? And they say, well, why am I transferred to Brighton? It's like, well, look, I mean, you turn up here and you used to score 4 goals. You don't score any anymore. Okay. But, yeah, but I don't let any in. Yeah, but, I mean, you're a striker. We need you to score goals, right?
Yeah.
Whereas if you turned up and you spent your 12 hours every day of like, okay, well, now I don't score 4 a game. I score 6 a game. And, oh, you let one in every blue moon. Oh, well, you know, we can manage that. 6-1 is much better than none and occasionally one or whatever else. Like, I think, and that I saw that time and time again. And in rugby, a classic one is weight.
Right.
So all these young lads come in, 18, 19 or whatever else, and they'll say to them, you know, they'll come in, they'll do some load of X Factor because they're really fast and mobile around the park, or they're good at the breakdown, da, da, da. And then some idiot coach will turn around and say, oh, Ollie, yeah, you're great at this, but like, we need you to put weight on. And you're too small, you're 80 kilos, you've got to put some weight on because you're going to get injured, you can do whatever else. So they spend all their time eating 50,000 calories a day, doing weights and doing whatever, and they end up in the middle at the end because they can't move around the park anymore as fast as they used to. They can't get onto the ball as fast as they used to. And at the end, they get sacked. And they go, why am I getting sacked? And so you're too slow, not nimble around the field anymore. And you're like, mate, this has all happened because you've sat down to this young lad and told him that the reason he's not going to make it in the game or in things he needs to work on are not actually the things he's really good at. And the reason why you signed him in the first place, it's stuff that, I mean, you're creating this sort of like dream scenario of like, oh, well, he's going to be super mobile at 19 stone. It just doesn't work, right? So that's for me is the biggest criticism I used to see. And these poor kids then like, oh, I've missed my dream and whatever else. Mm. It's just one person's opinion and cock up that's ruined their whole psyche and dynamic around it all. And that happens time and time again. So luckily, when I joined Newcastle, unfortunately, he's passed away now, but there was a guy called Steve Black who was our sort of mentor. He was the bloke behind Wilco. He actually did a load of work with Newcastle United, and he went with Clarkie at Fulham and a few other places. Huddersfield Town he went to.
Oh.
And Sunderland he worked with. And the first thing he put on my peg, first game ever that I played was, he just said, maximise your strengths, manage your weaknesses. I was like, what are you talking about, mate? Yeah. What are you talking about? And he just sort of said, just live by that. He said, yeah, you know all that stuff? Because, you know, Rob Andrew told us all this stuff. I remember he came over to me. Rob Andrew's like, gave me like 17 points before I ran on the field. Like, I've got to do this. So I was like, I'm not going to remember any of this. Like, quit running in PhD, right all up my arm. And Blackie came over and said, you know what he just said to you? And I said, yeah, what? He said, what did he say to you? I said, I don't know, like this. He said, forget it. Throw it out the window. I was like, what do you mean, forget it? He's told me I've got to do this. He said, when you get the ball in your hand, score. Every time you get the ball, score.
Yeah.
So what do you mean? So that's what we've been brought into, because we saw X Factor. When you play for the 21s, you scored 3 hat-tricks in a row. So when you go on the field, score a hat-trick. I can tell you what, Raj, you won't care anything about anything else.
Mm.
And that's all, and that's, I mean, so I didn't want it to become a weakness, right, in my game, so that then it became a glaringly obvious thing of, like, I couldn't do something, right? But, so I did work on areas of my game, of course, but if every time I hit the field, I was electric with a ball in my hand and I scared the life out of defenders because that was my job as a winger. I'm going to get picked. I'm going to get signed.
Mm.
You know, I'm not going to get signed if I don't do any of that. And you know, every time there's someone around me, I make my tackle because I don't actually deliver any X factor to the team. So it was just, I was just fortunate that I had the right coach because I was like a bit like you, Jim. I wanted love and bum taps and whatever else. And he knew that. He knew how to sort of manage me, and that was great. And I see it go wrong so many times in sort of young athletes now, that element.
because then you could also, especially as a young person, because you're, you know, you're, it's a vulnerable age and state to be in anyway, but you can really quickly then think you're rubbish at something when you're not. And it's a perspective thing. If someone's telling you you've got to work on these other things and you're not very good at them, but you're amazing at this particular thing, then you're still a good player. Mm. But it's really quick. And again, that can be translated into any industry, that if you're not sort of focusing on the thing you're good at and the thing you love, you can really quickly think you're rubbish at something when you're not. And yeah, that is a really, you know, difficult place to be in.
And that's the role that coaches play, right? I'll be honest, that's where they can be incredibly beneficial or incredibly detrimental, yeah, to a person's development. And when I say use the word coach, I don't just mean it in sport. It could be anything. It could be in a working environment, right?
Yeah.
And if more often than not, it's either it's what they've been conditioned to over their course of professionalism in sport, in business, or whatever else. So they've been habitualized to being hypercritical or blase, whatever it is, right? And then at the same time, they then mirror that onto the individual, right? They mirror that onto their this person coming in of like, well, if we focus on all the things you rubbish at, or get on your case, or, and actually the irony of it is, the physical and technical elements of it are, everyone's kind of in the ballpark anyway.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a few. Obviously, you can always, as an 18-year-old, you're going to get faster, bigger, stronger as you go through, anyway, as you mature naturally. But yeah, okay, you could do some elements of that. Definitely, but that's kind of easy stuff. The really great coaches are the ones that are like, okay, how do I make sure that my behaviour and the messaging that I give to Jim is exactly what Jim needs, so that he's at the best of his ability every single day? And actually, I need to do something slightly different for Giles. And as a result, you know what? These two are going to be sensational on the football field, or they're going to be sensational for my business, because I am, if you like, focusing on the sort of mental, emotional, psychological side of things that makes them want to go to war for me. Right? Yeah. They want to do everything for me because they feel that I resonate with them and that I understand them. Whereas so many coaches think it's about technical, it's about really dotting I's and crossing T's. And yeah, okay, there is, of course, there's detail that you've got to make sure it doesn't become a disaster. You don't want someone to sign a check with an extra zero on because they've, you know, messed it up. But in general, people aren't that stupid. But, you know, all the time, it's about, and equally, if they're emotionally invested in something, they'll want to double check and go to hell and back for you.
I was going to ask you about, obviously you touched on being a captain and that leadership on the pitch. Did that come naturally to you? Was that something that you did from a younger age, or was it something you sort of developed later on? And also, having that set of skills, were you able to implement some of the things you've just been saying about, you know, obviously the coach has the last word, but you're able to sort of coerce people into doing various things on the pitch that you could see could be done better?
Yeah, so, you know, ironically, actually, so some of my captaincy, I would have, if I were to critique myself, I would say was like really good in the fact that I tried to create an environment that was so fun and engaging. So I remember when we were, an example, when we went to Wellington, England had never, ever, ever won a tournament in New Zealand ever. So we're the first team to ever do that in 2009. And we beat New Zealand in the final. We went 17-0 down and we won it 19-17 on the Hilton,
wow,
right?
Wow, fucking hell. What a way to win it.
Epic experience. Like, by far, one of the best experiences of my life. That was on the tournament was a Saturday, Sunday. On the Thursday, this was totally out of the rule book. I didn't even tell the coach about this, whatever. But I arranged for the Harley Davidson owners group to come to our hotel. 35 Harley Davidsons pulled up, all skull and crossbones or whatever, and they put all the players on the back of their motorbikes and we went for a tour all around Wellington.
Oh my God, wow.
That culminated in them driving down the main high street of Wellington, revving all the engines up and setting off every car alarm as they went down. And we had, you know, England blazoned across our backs, right? So now, when I think of it now, I'm like, health and safety risk all over the place. Yeah, players on the back of motorbikes, like, absolute disaster, right? But the unity, the fun element of that, of like, wow, what a wicked experience, and how cool was that, and da-da-da-da-da, meant that we were just so relaxed, and we were so up for it, and we were just so united as a team, that when we went 17-0 down, like, no one even panicked. No one even, you know, and in front of 55,000 people, everyone hates us, obviously, with all the legacy and history of England never even got to a final, never even won anywhere. It was just epic, if I'm honest. It was just incredible. And I'm not saying, it, you know, everyone go get on Harley Davidsons and zoom around everywhere. But, like, so that element of my leadership, I would say, was really good. Like, okay, how do we just create as much fun and as relaxed an environment as possible? Where I was probably pretty naive and a bit immature, and it only got better at this, I think, actually, when once I'd retired and I did some of my other bits of, like, Everest and sailing around the world and all this sort of stuff, where I, in my naivety as an England captain, you know, I was pretty tell. You know, I was, like, screaming and shouting and, like, you know, we got to do this, and, you know. And to be honest, looking back on it, it was just pretty easy. I mean, I probably was talking a load of nonsense, if I'm honest. But, you know, you've got to remember, it was a load of blokes, all the same age, all the same marital status, all the same sort of, not identical, but, you know, legacy stuff of, like, playing as a kid and coming all the way through to play for England. You have this carrot of England. Yeah, if you can't really lead in that environment, you're pretty buggered, right? I mean, you've got everything that's in your favour. So, you know, the stark contrast for me was when I went to go and sail around the world, and I was on the Great Britain boat, and I was a late entry into this, and all these people had, you know, mortgaged their house. Some of them were doing it for loved ones that they'd lost, and, you know, invested every pound that they had in this. They'd been preparing for, like, 2-3 years. And when I was on, like, when I bowled up, like, 5 weeks to go, and was like, right, come on, we've got to win. They were like, why have we got to win? I'm not bothered about winning. Yeah. I said, what do you mean, not bother about winning? They're like, well, there's one woman who's like, well, I've got my husband's urn, who, you know, ashes here, who he died from cancer, and I promised him I'd sprinkle his ashes in every single one of the world's oceans. I don't care about winning. Yeah. I just want to make sure I don't spill him over the side.
Yeah.
You know, and then there was another woman, she was 74, Jill. She was like, well, look, I want to have one last experience before I die. I want to get thrown around the deck and whatever else. I was like, please don't have that last experience.
Yeah.
On the boat, right?
Yeah, I don't want that. Yeah.
But, you know, it made me realise, actually, no one, you know, what my goal and my aspiration is, it's not actually always the same. So I need to take a lot of time here to listen to what other people want, recognise what other people's motivations are, what makes them move, and then play to that, make sure I give them that. And then they might be invested in what I want. They might be interested in supporting around, okay, Ollie, how do we help you win or stand in your head or whatever else it is that I want to do. And that was definitely a sort of a bit of a wake-up call for me.
Yeah, I guess in between what you were saying there and then getting to the other stuff, I guess a big moment for you was your retirement, because you retired quite early, didn't you,
yeah,
through injury.
29.
29. So what rugby players normally play, it's the same as football, sort of mid-30s.
Yeah, I mean, in general, if you're lucky, you'll get to sort of, you know, 33, 34. Some go a bit beyond and others a bit early, like me.
And that, obviously, I'm guessing at that age, you're not even thinking about retiring, not ready for it. So it must have been a shock at the time. And I guess then it sort of brought on a lot of other sort of deeper feelings.
Yeah, massive. Yeah. Big shock. And I think, if you like, I'd got institutionalised and a bit conditioned to some of the negative elements of sport, which were limelight and, you know, being a somebody, in inverted commas, and whatever else. And I, when that, you know, I'd spent, 12 years as a professional athlete, and then as a somebody and being in the press and captain of England and all this sort of stuff. And then I was injured and was like, well, who cares about him now? You know, there's somebody else. There's always somebody else. There's a new captain. There's a new world player of the year. There's always something. There's another World Cup winner. So that, and I guess it was waving. I was in denial or a sort of refusal. I was chasing after more and more recognition. So, you know, I retired, got injured, and I was like, right, well, let's go and do this sale. So I left within 5 weeks of getting injured, basically, wow, and retiring. And then I was like, I was like, the face of this race. So it was like, I'm getting all the plaudits, and I'd create this delusions of grandeur that I thought I'd go and do this race and I could come back and my injury would suddenly be recovered and I'd go to the Olympics as a result of that. And then, I sort of chased attention and whatever else. And look, I wasn't a boozer. I wasn't into drugs. So, but I was into women and I was in, like, I wanted affection. I wanted attention. But it was really unhealthy because I was never, nothing was ever enough. I was never satisfied. So then you end up hurting people and hurting yourself and all the rest of it. Right. So yeah, it was probably not, it took a while, right? It took probably two and a half years before I was suddenly like, oh God, I'd still introduce myself. I remember I got a job at PwC in 2015 and I would introduce myself for about 2 years after that. I was like, oh, hi, I'm Ollie. I used to play rugby.
Yeah.
It was my whole identity. It was everything who I was. And I thought it gave me credibility. It was my persona. It was my, why somebody would be more interested in me at that point rather than just who I was. So everything about me was that. And it was, as I said, it wasn't for about 2.5 years until I suddenly was like, oh, I'm not a rugby player anymore. And I'm going to have to transition over and do something else here. And I'd come from being like a specialist, an expert in my field, to now having to go and learn something else where I wasn't an expert in my field anymore. And I was my early 30s and I'd got conditioned to being, really good at something and people appraising me and whatever else. I didn't want to be a novice at whatever else I was going to go into next. And I really struggled with that. I really, really struggled with that acceptance and that transition of like, okay, got to start over again here now and just accept, we it's going to be a bumpy ride and at the end it will all come okay. But I really struggled with that initially.
Especially as, because I struggle with the idea of like the age milestone. So in football, I guess in sport, you're told like 30 years old. So if you're starting again at early 30s, you feel like you're like way behind everybody else. When actually 30 is still very, very young. And I'm 38 now, so I've got like 40 creeping up. I'm sort of having the same sort of feelings like, oh God, what have I done? What am I going to do? Where's my life going? What benchmarks have I got? But actually, again, 40 is very young. You've still got so many years left to do. But I don't know if it's a sport thing that could like mould your mind into thinking, if you're not doing amazing things by these benchmarks, you're behind somehow.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe some of that's linked to like just physical attributes, right? Just in terms of the functionality of your body. Like when you're in your teens and your 20s, you can do a hell of a lot more and more frequently than you can at 40. And as a result, people label that as like, oh well, you're not as useful as you were or whatever else. And then that perception just builds in your own mind, right? And because it's an immediate sensation, right? So I don't know, if you and I go for a sprint race now in our 40s, or I'm 39, so nearly 40 as well, but like our late 30s, we're not going to be able to do it as often or be anywhere near as fast as we were as a 18-year-old or 20-year-old. Yeah. And we feel that, right? We can noticeably feel that, even though we think psychologically, I'm still as fast as I was at 18. I still feel the same as I did when I was 20.
Yeah.
And that starts to build up all these barriers in our mind of like, well, I can't go sprint anymore because I wasn't as good as I used to be. So therefore, there's no point doing it.
Yeah.
And actually, from the conversation we had earlier, it's easier said than done, right? But it's less about the outcome of like, oh wow, well my sprint is now still 10.5 what I used to do as a 18-year-old or whatever else, and more just about the process of like, I just like running.
Mm, yeah,
I just really like running, and I'm quite like that feeling of the wind in my face and whatever else. And like, and so it's about the process rather than the outcome. And I think that's quite hard for people to get their heads around because we are so outcome driven. Everything in society and us is all about, well, have we gone from A to B? Has it, rather than,
well, what have we learned? And even if we didn't get to B, what could enable us to maybe get to B next time, and that we've learned and we get better at? And it's sort of relishing that part of it, which I think people find pretty challenging, right? And because mentally you're still the same person, you still feel the same way,
but you're still doing well. And also if you do something and you're sorry, it is really difficult to change your focus on that, but if you do something because you enjoy it and you love it, well, you probably will get to B. And if you don't get to B, you'll probably get to C or D, which is still progress, but it might be somewhere else. But you still get better by the sheer virtue of doing it, and probably quicker because you're enjoying it rather than doing something, thinking about the outcome and thinking about how you get better at it. But that is a hard mind shift. I do get that.
Yeah, and that's what I noticed, if I'm honest, from my, let's say, I don't know, rugby career to post my rugby career. Like, I've done lots of things that I loved afterwards now. Of like, I don't know, I cycled across America with my wife and some, as a race, right, as family. We didn't win the race. No, near the race. Equally, I'm not harbouring any ambitions of being Geraint Thomas or you know, Lance Armstrong or anything like that in terms of cyclists, right? Whereas in my rugby career, if I was going to do something, it wasn't worth doing it unless I was going to be the best at it.
Yeah.
And so ultimately, I missed out on loads of things because I thought, well, I'm not very good at that, so I won't do it. Right. Whereas now I quite just enjoy the process of, you know, as I said, we did manage to cycle across America. Were we the fastest? No. Am I going to be a professional cyclist? No. But was it a cool experience? Yes, it was.
Yeah, amazing.
It was absolutely epic. It was an unbelievable journey, amazing process, and obviously a great sense of achievement at the end of it all. And I think that's I'm nowhere near the finished article, but that was the major transition that I noticed in me, which was, I know, becoming less outcome driven, less competitive around certain things. I'm still a competitive beast, but just actually enjoying, you know, where I'm taking my body, my mind, and whatever else, rather than worrying about, like, is this better than everybody else? And if it isn't, well, there's no point doing it, because that became a pretty negative thing for me, and as a result, I'd miss out on loads of things because I talked myself out of it.
Yeah, and you could argue doing those amazing experiences, like, you know, you've done all sorts of things. If you've been trying to be competitive, you may not have enjoyed those experiences as much. You may have not taken in those experiences as much doing it. And actually just being involved in those things in the first place is amazing.
But that's, you know, it comes back to your point, Jim, originally, of like the societal pressure of not succeeding, in inverted commas, right? So everyone's judgment is like, have you made the most money or have you run the fastest time? And if you haven't, it's like, oh, look at that. Look at that bloke. Isn't that ridiculous? Like, he's like a minute behind everybody else.
Yeah.
And then as a result, you feel a fool, right? You feel a failure and this perception of like, oh, I don't want people to think of me in that way, because it's pretty uncomfortable, right? It's uncomfortable when you think people are laughing at you or whatever else, because, you know, you've tried something and you've not been very good at it in terms of, you know, you're not the fastest or the quickest or the strongest or make the most money or whatever else. Whereas, and that's hard. That's a hard transition to make. Of like, you know what? I'm not doing this for anybody else except for me. You know. Yeah. And so actually, I'm running. It's like that Eric the Eel thing.
Yeah.
You know, the swimmer of like, well, if he really cared about everybody else and their perception, he'd never have got in the pool. Because he'd have known, I'm nowhere near as fast as Michael Phelps, whatever else, and he'll have finished and had a shower and got changed, but you know, before I've actually finished the race. But and so most people just wouldn't get in the pool.
Yeah,
they just wouldn't even do it, even though they love swimming.
Mm.
And that's probably the sorry state, the sad state of like what comes as an outcome of, if you like, societal pressure and competition now, is that so many people don't do things because of the way they feel others will react to them, their perception of that. And as a result, it's,
you know, it's debilitating, it's nerve-wracking, and they miss out on something that might feel pretty fulfilling for them at the end of it all.
So true.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's like sort of the guy that comes last in the 100 metres final. Everyone's like, oh, well, he's not very good. He got to the 100 metre final. He's probably quite good at running.
Of course, yeah.
And well, it's like when, you know, if you do, you know, if you've done a marathon or a long race or anything like that, everyone, the first thing that people will ask you is, what time did you do it in?
Yeah.
Where did you come? And you think, well, actually, I started not telling people what the time I'm doing. I just said,
and I'll be honest
did it.
With you, it's actually harder to run for 5.5 hours than it is for two, right? I mean, two, you're on your feet for 2 hours and you're done. You put your feet. Actually, keeping going and mentally, physically, keeping your mind, body ticking over for 5.5 hours is so much harder.
Yeah, it's horrendous. Yeah. So, speaking from experience.
So the irony of it is, people who are taking longer, they should be getting even more praise.
Yeah, like, well, absolutely.
Well done. I mean, Jesus Christ, because I would have quit at 4 hours or I don't know, whatever, right? So, like, but you're right. It's because everything is, can we be bigger, faster, stronger, richer, whatever else it is, it's all geared towards more, rather than actually the process of it. Mm. It's just the process and enjoyment of it all.
Do you know, it's so funny on this podcast how like we have guests that come on that tell us stuff when we need to hear it, because this is really timely for me, because I'm going to the Edinburgh Fringe next week to do a month's run at the Fringe doing a stand-up show.
Awesome.
And I'm really looking forward to it. But also filled with those feelings of anxiety and is anyone going to turn up? Is it going to go well? Am I going to get noticed? All that kind of stuff. But actually, and I have been trying to do this, but you talking about today has actually really helped me kind of shift that framework. So like, I really like the show that I do. The show is really good. It's fun. It's silly. It's gentle. It's great. So I'm trying to focus on that. And I enjoy performing it. So I'm just trying to focus on enjoying the show. And then whatever happens around it happens. If I sell out every night, great. If I get patchy audiences, hopefully they'll still like it. You know, if I get agents coming to see it, great. But if I don't, I can talk to agents afterwards and say, I don't know, they're on the Fringe. It's all like reframing it. Yeah. But as long as I enjoy the actual show and performing it, then hopefully that stuff comes with it. But again, it's hard. Edinburgh is so competitive. And you see other acts and they've got, you know, they're getting featured in the Telegraph and stuff. And you're like, why am I not getting that kind
of
coverage?
You don't want to be in the Telegraph, mate.
Well, you know, but it's because they've spent $4,000 on PR. You know, so there's always a reason for these kind of things. But I am who I am with my setup and stuff, and I'm trying to really focus on the enjoyment of, you know, doing the Fringe is amazing and enjoying it, and then whatever comes. So I'm glad it's been really interesting talking to you today, because I think I needed to hear that.
And Jim, that's when you hear people talking about it's, you know, some of these cliche things, but like controlling the controllables, right? So for you, the one thing that you can be in control of is actually, what enjoyment am I going to get out of this?
Yeah.
Like, why am I doing this in the first place? If the rationale and reason is driven by, I want agents, thousands of people to come and watch me and praise me and whatever else, you're not really in control of any of that. Yeah. So as a result, you've got a real chance of being pretty disappointed.
Yeah.
Because, I don't know, even if it is a full house, you'd be like, oh, there's 3 seats on there and I'm disappointed there or whatever else, right? Well, if it's like, you know what, even if this room's empty, I just love this show. I just love, like, the feeling of telling my gags or telling these stories and getting up and being a different human being, like creating a different persona and whatever else. That gives me fulfillment, that gives me enjoyment. If there's a load of people that want to come see me do this and, like, think I'm funny, well, that's what a bonus that is.
Yeah.
I'm teaching you suck eggs, but I think that's where so many people are, if you like, maybe just driven by the wrong things, and that's easy just to say, right? Because, you know, we all want people to turn up and say, oh, it's really good, rather than it's really bad.
Yeah.
But if you can almost numb yourself to that and be like, you know, that's not the reason I'm coming, and that's not the reason why I've invested so much of my time and energy into creating a show, and I'm going up to Edinburgh for a whole month and giving up all that time in my life, and like, the reason I'm doing it is because I love it.
Yeah.
Well, that, and that comes back, I guess, full circle to, I lost sense when I was playing rugby, probably in the middle of my career, like 27, 28, where I didn't really know why I was doing it.
Yeah.
I was probably driven by like the fame and the money and where I was, rather than when I was 16, 17, of like, I play for free.
Yeah.
You know, and I noticed it. I really noticed it. And I actually tried to change it at 29, where I was like, I turned down some big lucrative contract offers with some clubs to go and play and try and play in the Olympics. I wanted to go to Rio 2016.
that was my focus. And I wasn't going to get any money really for it. It was the least paid of it all. But I felt like super excited about it. I felt like it was my raison d'etre for doing stuff. Yeah. And obviously, like, you know, there was the accolade still of like being an Olympian and all that sort of stuff. But I was like, I really want to be, I just want to experience that thing. That's what I want to do. And unfortunately, I got injured, you know, I got injured in it. But it was the only time I'd sort of readjusted and retuned back into what it was all about. And I remember, because I got injured, I felt like there was no closure on my career. Mm. And I went to Cambridge University to do an executive MBA. I was 34? And when I was there, the rugby club approached and said, look, we'd really love you to, do you want to have a go again? And so I turned up on a Monday night to run around with these like 22-year-old students. And it was the best thing I ever did in my life, because it was like, they weren't getting paid, and it was just a crack. And it was this opportunity of playing in the varsity match. And I remember I got to play in the varsity match in 2018. I was 36, and my wife was in the crowd, and she said there was like a couple or something nearby who leant over, and they're like, oh, I didn't realise they let professors play in the varsity match. Because I got so old. Right. But I remember I was on the field for 78 and a half minutes, and I just loved every single minute of it. Because for me, it was
amazing.
It was the closure I needed. And I was like, I'm at like the home of rugby where it all began, where all as a 5-year old, all I wanted to do was play at Twickenham and all that sort of stuff. And I was doing it for all the right reasons this time.
Mm. Yeah.
And it was the most. I actually did nothing in the whole game, and it was just the best. But it was the best experience I ever had in my life, and it was the closure I sort of needed for those exact reasons of I'm just playing because I want to play, because I love it, because you know, I play for free. It's the enjoyment factor of this, like, and that it was. I count myself very lucky for that opportunity, because otherwise I probably would have retired with a few regrets and you know. Always wondering what if, but it was a cracking end for me anyway.
That's amazing.
I love that.
Yeah. So, Jim, I hope it goes well, mate. I hope it's amazing up there.
Thank you. Hopefully, yeah, I think it will be. I'm trying to go with the right mindset. It's going to be difficult because I'm doing the show about my, well, nearly 3-year-old daughter. So I'm going to be reminded of her while being away from her, which is going to be difficult. Although I do get to see them in the middle, because my brother's getting married in Ireland in the middle of the run. So I'll hopefully get to see them there. But my wife is also 6 months pregnant as well. So I'm not quite sure how I've swung this one. But so it's going to be difficult being away from them. But they're very supportive. And I love the show. So, yeah. Fingers crossed. I can't even promote it now, because by the time this episode comes out, I think the Edinburgh will be over. But
I mean, hey, good luck. My wife and I, we've got 3 kids, 4, 2, and 10 months. So it's chaos.
Wow.
So
chaos. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, wow.
But yeah, good luck. It's going to be great. What a great experience.
Thank you.
Ollie, I wanted to ask you about Optimist Performance, because you started that in 2018, is that right, around that time?
Yeah, a bit earlier. We sort of became serious then, if that makes sense.
Tell us a bit about how it came about and what it is.
Well, originally it was just, you know, me turning up and telling a few war stories and stuff like that about, you know, and then I got quite bored of hearing my own voice, if that makes sense. And I realised that actually, you know, I don't really like talking about myself that much, but what I do love doing is creating experiences, right? Stories, narratives that really help unite people. And what am I passionate about? Well, I'm really passionate about building teams and helping people fulfill their potential. Those are the things that I worship. I love doing, right? I take massive pleasure out of that. So I thought, well, can I leverage and use some of my experiences of Everest and rugby and sailing and whatever else? So, and distill those into some sort of, let's call it like learning platforms, learning modules. But actually the thing that I'm passionate about, and I love the most, and where all my learnings come from, is not from any books. It's come from, okay, bloody hell, we're in the middle of the North Pole here, and what do we do? Someone's just fallen through the ice and blah, 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 right? You know, like, and how, so I didn't want to recreate someone falling through the ice in North Pole, but what I wanted to do was, how do we create scenarios, situations, experiences, context that allows people to touch and feel these things we talk about all the time? So everyone's like, oh, what does it take to be a good communicator? And they'll list out a whole load of things. But can I put you in a situation, a challenge or an experience or a scenario that is, I don't know, time pressured, that is person sensitive, that is, you know, fiscally challenging, or I don't know, whatever it is, right? To test if you're a good communicator. And then let's record it, and then let's play it back and say, Jim, you've told me that this is how you'd like to communicate. Da, 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 da. We just created this situation for you. Bum, 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 bum. These are the rules. This is what you did. Do you think that is that a good reflection? What happened in that moment? What did you do? How did you feel? What went through your mind that suddenly, you know, you had a team of 10, but you just spoke to two people, and these other three over here, they went and got a cup of tea, and they had no idea what you were talking about, right? What happened there? Why did that happen? How, like, if we were to play this again, what would you do differently? And then that's, for me anyway, that's how, you know, people, if you like, practice, that's how people get better. They put them into scenarios, they get better, and as a result, they can, if you like, touch and feel what being a good communicator is for them, right? Rather than me just saying, here you go, Jim, here's all these things, and then they walk out of the room, they're like, it sounds good, I don't really know how to do it, I don't know how to put it together. And so that's sort of, I don't know, that's where we sort of began, Giles, and that's what it's sort of flourished into now, which is we do three things: executive coaching, so supporting people one-on-one, mentoring, whatever, around their own personal growth and their own personal journey, coupled then with, let's call it behavioural change, but how do we create, I'm obsessed by creating a sea of optimists, right? I call it the eternal optimist. So how do we create our sea of optimists, these people that think, feel, do optimism, and whatever that means for them. And we build that across the third bit, which is like experiential scenarios, events, whatever you want to call it, like, but building that sort of narrative for people. And obviously it was starting to go pretty well, then COVID hit and it didn't go very well, and we managed to sort of stay through that. And obviously the irony of it is, at that point in time, so many people were sort of feeling a plethora of emotions, right? And you know, the lack of community, the lack and the anxiety that comes through being on their own, whatever else, and transition from, like, okay, we used to see everyone every day, now it's once every 6 months. So all of that happened, we managed to sort of get through that, and now we're seeing a real take up in what we do, right? Because I think we're pretty good at it, and we've got our sea of optimists. We've probably got 30, 35 people now in the business that have different walks of life, from sport, business, adventure, that cover different areas, from mental health, diversity, inclusion, nutrition, leadership, teams, communication, and we bring that into the hotspots of, like, okay, how do we help this business or this team become the best version of themselves? And often it starts with, like, okay, what does that mean? What are the big rocks that we're going to build our values upon? You know, so what are the things we can't walk past without commenting on, right? Because loads of people, right, I don't know, you go into so many companies and be like, oh, what are your values? And they'll be like, oh, leadership, honesty, trust. Yeah. You're like, okay, cool. Well, tell me what trust means then. What does that mean? Like, Giles, every time when you walk into work, every single day, what do you do that demonstrates trust? How do you live and breathe being trustworthy as a behaviour?
Yeah.
Because that's the only way it becomes of any meaning and it delivers any real value. Otherwise, it's just a word. It's just a word that people will chant. And then, I don't know, when the proverbial hits the fan, they compromise it. It's really only under pressure when it all gets tested anyway. It's like, okay, well, there's a decision to make here, and, you know, we're on a deadline, and actually I'm behind on this program, and I trust that Giles is going to do it, and he doesn't. Yeah, or other way around, I trust Ollie's going to do it, and I don't, because I see an opportunity that I can get one over Giles, and maybe that means I get promotion or whatever else. Well, then all these values of, like, trust, honesty, integrity, we'll just chuck them out the window. Because you're not actually doing it. Not doing the right thing, and living to the and but it's a bit like any form of skill. You can't just do it. You know,
us three could not turn up tomorrow. Maybe you could, Jim Giles, and play for Palace in the Premiership, right?
Like, it'd be a stretch.
Yeah. We like to think we can. Right? but no, you have to live and breathe it every single day in order to become the best footballer or best version of yourself. And it's the same on those values. Like, if you don't turn up every day and genuinely hold a mirror up to yourself at the end of it and say, you know what, today I was trustworthy. This is what I did. Yeah. I acted with honesty and integrity. You know what, it was really hard. Today was really hard because there was an opportunity for me to actually get something for my own good, or, you know, further my own career, or, like, I don't know, whatever else it is. But you know what, I didn't compromise on my values. I acted with integrity. I acted with trust. Like, it's really, really hard, and but you have to live and breathe it and practice it every day, and then it becomes a habit. And so that's what we try and do anyway. Sorry, Charles, that was the long
it's amazing. No,
it's fascinating.
Yeah, it's really great, and it's great that you've that it's picking up again after COVID and stuff. And you know, sounds like a vital thing that I'm sure a lot of corporations, businesses, and sports teams, whoever, would really benefit from.
But a lot of this stuff, right, is this is my favorite. Right, it's common sense, but it's just not common practice, right?
Yeah.
You know, everyone says it. I mean, everyone will say, like, what do you think are all the key values that you need to show every day? It's like, if I said to someone, do you think it's really good that you nick a tenner out of someone's wallet every day? Yeah. It's like, oh, no, that's not very good. It's not very good. So, well, like, do you think that shows trust and honesty and integrity if you, jump in front of somebody in the queue every single day, or nick their, whatever it is, I don't know whether that's a bad example. They'd be like, no, it doesn't. Well, then why do we do it?
Yeah.
Like, if it genuinely matters to you that you want to be whatever these values are, like, why do we constantly contradict ourselves? That's all. And so it's, and more often than not, it's people don't even realise they're doing it. And you just, it's about holding the mirror up to people and, you know, keeping them accountable and all that sort of stuff. And yes, as I say, it's a bit like weight loss. We couldn't, even though we'd love to, we probably couldn't walk into the gym today, and if we did 8 hours in the gym, we're not going to look like Arnold Schwarzenegger when we come out. You know, you have to go every day for 10 years of your life, and that's a big sacrifice. It's a big discipline, and it's the same thing of, like, being a decent, trustworthy, honest person. Every day you've got to do it. Every day, the day you compromise yourself, the day you do a cheat and you don't go to the gym and you eat a chocolate bar, you're like, well, I got away with that today, I might do it again tomorrow. It's the same thing. Like, you know, day you cheat on your husband, cheat on your wife, whatever, you think, oh, I got away with that. And, like, it's the same thing. There's probably extreme examples, but it's not living and breathing the values that, if they're really important to you, you've got to be disciplined around. And that's probably pretty boring for people to listen to, but it's
no,
the truth,
not at all.
I love the way you use Arnold Schwarzenegger as a bodybuilder as well. Really showing your age and our age as well that we can get that reference. I'm sure there's a younger version. Yeah. I don't know.
Don't know if I'd like to look like him now. But there you go.
I like the idea of when you're talking about the challenges and the self-reflection. I think that's important. Like, I've been filming all my previews running up to the Fringe, and, like, although it's awkward to look back at them, I think we all find it a bit awkward sometimes, like, watching and self-reflecting and stuff, it's been really useful. And, like, looking at where I'm doing well, where I'm not doing well, and that's actually been really, really helpful in sculpting the show. But it can feel awkward sometimes looking back at yourself.
Of course,
and also, what's been really interesting is watching back and thinking, oh, I'm quite good at this. Like, some of this is quite good, and that's been a nice feeling as well.
Yeah, and that's also for some people really awkward, right? Because they're not conditioned to actually thinking about themselves in a positive light, and so all these things it's about. Yeah, but as you go through that process, you just get more and more accustomed to it, and you get more and more habitualized around it, and then it becomes easier. And I think that's the key to anything, right? It's not the old practice makes permanent, right? But because nothing's ever permanent, right? But I just think it just enables you to be a lot more clearer about everything.
Yeah.
Ollie, it's been such a fascinating conversation, and thank you so much for your time. I know we've taken a lot of time.
Thanks so much.
Yeah,
really,
thank you so
it.
Much. Thank you. Really appreciate your time, and thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been great to chat to you.
Awesome. Cheers, boys.
Ollie Phillips, what a top bloke. What a fantastically inspirational person. Some great stories, great anecdotes. And, you know, the stuff he's doing now as well with Optimist Performance is changing people's lives. So what a top bloke. Ticks every box of Blank Podcast, to be honest.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant. Could listen to him for days. Could have asked him way more nerdy questions about sport, which I do. Or we both do, yeah. In the patron section. Of course, we do extra content for all our patrons each week with every single guest. So I got to ask him actually a question I've always wanted to ask a rugby player. So we're going to put that in the patron as well. So if you want to hear that and extras from all our guests every week, go to patreon.com, patreon.com/blankpodcast. And it's in there. But just aside from that, great interview with an absolutely top bloke. And we really, really wish him all the best for the future as well, because he's doing good things.
Yeah, I think probably, well, I know you said you certainly like talking in the podcast that you needed that little pep talk.
Yeah.
And I felt like we did get like a bit of the Optimist Performance kind of talk, which is great. You know, it was great to hear some of that stuff. And that's obviously stuff that he passes on when he does those talks. And he has his Optimist warriors that go out and that help with corporations and leadership and sports teams and all sorts of things. And I felt like I needed that as well. And I know you said you vocalized that. You said you wanted that this week because of with Fringe coming up. But I think, it was really useful to hear some of those things.
Yeah. It's funny how that happens on the pod, doesn't it? Like, just timing-wise, things seem to pop up when you need them. It's probably the same in life, actually, in general, if you look out for them. But, like, yeah, it was just the right time for him to come on and talk about that kind of stuff. So,
he was a guest we needed at this moment, isn't it? It's funny.
And again,
the universe spoke to us.
We don't do this on purpose. We just book it when we book it and they come on and stuff. But it's just like, it was an ideal guest for this week. And I'm sure our listeners have enjoyed that and has got as much out of it as we did as well. So thank you so much to Ollie.
And I will caveat that you don't have to be into rugby to enjoy this conversation. Yeah. This is like, we do talk about rugby, obviously, but there's so much more to it.
Yeah, but that's where he's so good as well, because he's able to talk about his experiences from that game but actually make them applicable for whatever you do. And that's what makes him so good at what he does.
And he's done so many amazing things. Like, he's sailed around the world. In 11 months it took them.
Yeah.
Sailed around. He's done Arctic walks and
Everest.
He's cycled across America. He's done some amazing Kilimanjaro. So, fair play to Ollie. He's really, really taken life by the bullet. Life by the horns.
Life by the horn. Yeah, that's the one.
The bull of life.
The bull by the...
the life of bull. The bull of life, he's taken by the horns.
We'll put a link below.
I'm not going to become an Optimist warrior anytime soon.
We'll put a link below to Optimist Performance and the stuff he's doing now, so you can check it out if you like the sound of it as well. But thank you so much to Ollie for coming on, giving us his time. It was a real joy talking to him, so it was great. I'm sure you guys enjoyed it and got as much out of it as we did as well. Another good episode in the can.
I know.
We're lucky, aren't we?
Lucky.
Well, I'm going to get back to the Fringe, get back to doing my show. So hopefully I'll see some blank people up there.
Did you cut a Fringe for the Fringe?
I do sort of have one, but I sort of wear it up, don't I?
Wear it up?
Well, I have the sort of, I wear it like a sort of
That's
like
you put it
thing.
In a ponytail. Or you wear it up.
It's not. My hair line is not that strong for that. But
I do what I can.
No man buns for me. No, I do what I can with it. I used to have a fringe. I used to, but I've grown past that now.
Yeah, I've had bowl cuts in the past. Been
me
horrendous.
Too.
Horrendous.
Me too.
It's like child trauma.
It's a bit. That's why I'm so obsessed with my hair. Anyway, that's for another episode when we get a hairdresser on.
Well, we are going to get one soon. So there we go. There's a little insight into the future.
Oh my God, almost like we planned it.
Yeah.
Right. Anyway, okay. Have a good week, mate. I will see you next week for another episode on the Blank Podcast. Until then, have a good week.
And you.
Same to all our listeners. And we'll see you again very soon on the Blank Podcast. Goodbye.
This is a Blast Box Media Podcast.